Hello, I'm Genevieve Costigan. Welcome to Talking Teaching.
What we find in our research with children engaged in social and emotional learning programs is that they absolutely relish it. They love having structured opportunities to talk about things that actually matter in everyday life, not just the big issues of the world.
With the move to stricter lockdowns in Victoria and increasing restrictions in other parts of Australia, the COVID-19 pandemic remains a stark reminder of how much our lives have changed in 2020. This has been a particularly challenging time for young people, with schools opening and closing and the shift to remote learning. Professor Helen Cahill, Director of the Youth Research Centre at the University of Melbourne, is a leading innovator in school-based wellbeing interventions, and she has just published a new report for the Melbourne Graduate School of Education that examines how social and emotional learning programs can assist young people dealing with traumatic situations that can also mitigate trauma if implemented early enough. I started by asking Helen what sort of behaviour we might see in school students after they've been through a period of disruption or trauma.
Some of the things that teachers may notice in students who've been affected by distress and trauma associated with either the pandemic, the bushfires, or other emergencies or forms of family trauma is that for some children, they may find it really hard to settle and concentrate and to retain their focus on their work. So that can appear to the teacher like a drop-in engagement, like perhaps they're not interested anymore. But really it might just be a sign that they're finding it hard to focus. Just as we find it hard to focus as adults in the workplace when we're distracted by our personal lives. The other way that it can show up is quite curiously the opposite, that some students will become quite unmanageable in their behaviour, get into a lot more conflicts and fights with their friends, be resistant to the teacher's instructions and become difficult to manage. Now, that doesn't always look to teachers or parents, for that matter, as if it's a sign of distress. But for some children, acting out in an angry way is the way they express anxiety. Other children may exhibit signs we're more familiar with as a sign of upset, like becoming teary. Other children, again, and this happens more perhaps with younger children, is sometimes they regress to an earlier stage in their development. So they were independent from their parents coming to school, but they become clingy again, much as a younger child might. So those forms of dropping back in developmental capacity can sometimes be noted, particularly by primary school teachers.
Teachers are often in a perfect situation to notice a change in children because they know them so well. What are the signs that would make a teacher see the need to refer a student onto a mental health professional?
Teachers do a lot of observing of their classes. They even, of course, have found ways to observe remotely when they're teaching from home-based schooling. They notice what's consistent for that child. What's a usual pattern for them? Are they usually attentive, engaged, and keen to participate? Are they usually a bit shy or withdrawn? Do they usually find it difficult to get along with certain classmates? So a change in a pattern is sometimes a thing that a teacher is alerted to, particularly if it's not a positive change in a pattern. And so they tend to watch more when they notice a change in pattern. It's part of normal teaching work to try to figure that out. Is it because the work is too challenging or their literacy level can't handle this task I've given, or is it something in the peer or family or emotional life of the child? So they follow, I guess, what seem like hunches but are actually observations of patterns of behaviour. Now, from time to time in teaching, all teachers will experience that you become more than worried or confused about a particular child. Their pattern might have become very irregular or inconsistent or taken a downward trajectory. In those cases, people escalate their observation. Effective teachers often approach the child and check in with them. Things don't look quite the same for you. Could you be tired or not feeling so good or unwell or something's bothering you? What do you think's going on? Would you like to tell me? Sometimes children respond very well to that proactive approach from teachers. Other times they don't because it's too difficult for them to speak on the matter. Many children who are distressed really hold it in because they don't want to show their distress at school in case other people notice and they feel embarrassed. So they're very proud and independent about that. If the teacher can't get anywhere, particularly with the overtures to the child, or if they do find a child letting on or sending sort of yes signals to the fact that there is some significant distress, particularly distress they can't talk about, they would typically forward that information on in the school, consulting either their wellbeing coordinator or senior staff members or principal in the school, depending on the school structure, and sometimes checking in with other people who teach the same class if it's a secondary school.
So what are the risk factors for families that tend to be escalated during a natural disaster or a pandemic? So who are the most vulnerable children we should be looking out for?
One of the things we know from an extensive body of research around how children and young people cope post-disaster or post-conflict or exposure to war as a form of disaster is that there tends to be a certain kind of pattern to who is most affected. We often presume it's the children who are closest to the emergency itself, but that's not necessarily always so. What tends to happen is the children who are most disadvantaged before the emergency are the most affected during and afterwards. And that's for a lot of different reasons. One is that different traumas can co-occur and stick to each other and accumulate. For example, my parents are out of work. One of my parents has developed a mental illness, problem with depression or alcohol or something like that. Things are tough in the home. Because things are tough, there's more conflict. Sometimes then there may also be expressions of violence. These are all multiple forms of distress or trauma to a child. And so when they accumulate and add to each other, that makes that child more vulnerable to experiencing post-traumatic stress. The logic is actually they're experiencing more than one form of trauma. The other thing is we can look at it in the opposite way, not just what places some children more at risk than others as a general group, but what is protective for children even though they're exposed to risk and trauma. Protective factors are known to be things like I have a strong connection with my parent or caregiver. So in my family, we can talk about some things that matter. These are protective factors for kids. So then even if that family is hugely challenged by multiple forms of disadvantage, they also have that protective factor which helps to balance it out.
So what does reconnecting to education provide young people after they've been through some sort of traumatic event?
Connection to school, to education, to peers and to teachers are all protective factors in young people's lives. In times of happiness and ease and calm, and in times of emergency and distress. So what does that connectedness really mean? Connectedness to peers means I have got people who I think like me and I think I like them and I can interact with them. That gives me social support and a feeling of inclusion and that I'm somehow normal and part of things. Connection to teachers means that I feel I've got another adult watching over me who cares for me now and also cares for my future. Connectedness to school is the way we sum up basically a belief in being part of the academic goals of the school. That is, I feel like I want to be part of learning so learning can be good for me. And I want to try hard at school and my school wants me to try hard and they will help me to do that. So that's what connectedness to learning and to school is all about. When you have all three in place, that's a set of three very powerful protective factors for children.
Your report discusses at length the importance of social and emotional learning programs in schools. Can you tell me a little bit about what social and emotional learning is?
Social and emotional learning is an approach to teaching children that sets out to explicitly teach them things like the skills they need to get along with others, to problem solve, to give peer support, to help seek when things get too tough. To work out how to make ethical choices for themselves, how to have the courage to carry them out when not everyone else is going the same way as them. So these are everyday kind of people, relationship and life skills. Within social and emotional learning, we also set out to help kids develop some literacy and some concepts to better understand what's going on for themselves, not just in everyday life, but as big life challenges come or as they're stretched as they're rethinking and growing themselves as they develop through their childhood and into adulthood. So it's those skills for self-reflection, self-understanding. And along with that, the skills that you need to help you manage yourself when you're around other people. So how to use positive coping strategies when you feel challenged or distressed or you have to deal with a big change, rather than unproductive strategies that might either be hurtful to other people or harmful to yourself.
And how did students react when they first start doing this sort of work if they haven't done anything like this before? What's their response?
What we find in our research with children engaged in social and emotional learning programs that we've developed for primary and secondary schools is that they absolutely relish it. They love having structured opportunities to talk about things that actually matter in everyday life, not just the big issues of the world, but the micro things like, is this an appropriate way to treat a friend or not, particularly when your parent says this and your friend says that. So these nitty-gritty issues of life are important to young people. The other thing they like about social emotional learning, as well as its relevance, is the fact that it connects them to each other. So the design of the lessons in social emotional learning is that children do a lot of peer-to-peer work, interacting in small groups, problem-solving tasks with small groups, mixing with different groups to do different mini discussions, doing little role plays and games to try out their ideas and see what it would take to carry them in practice in real life. They really like this because it's applied. That is, it's helping them to do the stuff they care about. In fact, our research with children in both primary and secondary schools shows that children themselves identify that the biggest challenge to do with schooling is their peer relationships. That is what they want help with. They know their teachers can help them with learning stuff, but who's going to help them with relationships? So they get a lot of fun, they get a lot of relevance, and they get a lot of connectedness out of their time spent in social emotional learning programs. And further to that, they find that it connects them more to their teachers because they can see it helps them to have their teachers get to know them as a person. And in a curious way, it also helps children to better imagine that their teachers are actually people, not just creatures who live in a school and pop out in front of the desk when the bell rings, as some primary children imagine.
What's the genesis for these kinds of programs? When did they start operating in schools? And has there been any resistance to them?
Social emotional learning, in a way, has a long history, as in, you know, schooling over the years has had an interest in character formation of children and young people and values education in different ways. But the more explicit field that we now call social emotional learning is a much more recent phenomenon. So really across the last 15 to 20 years, people have set out to design them and to study them and study their impact on children, particularly in carefully constructed trials comparing groups of children who have access to them versus those who don't, and then looking to see, do the learning outcomes and wellbeing outcomes, are they measurable? Are they real? Do they last over time? And do they occur in different age groups and across different cultures, contexts, and nations? And the exciting thing about that body of research, which has really taken off in the last 10 years, is that the findings are very consistent. Compared to children who don't get access to this kind of explicit learning, the children who do have far better wellbeing outcomes. That means less depression, less anxiety, reduced rates of post-traumatic stress disorder after emergencies and disasters, less involvement in violence, bullying, homophobia, homophobic practices, and interestingly also for educators, improved attainment in learning. That is, their learning scores, the academic results go up compared to children who don't do the programs. And there's a lot of thinking about why that might be so. But for me, it makes sense that if children are in happy, settled, friendly, purposeful classrooms, they're just a lot more freed up to get on with their learning. Problematically, really, there is still some resistance. It's not so much the resistance born of, I don't agree with this, this isn't important. It's a structural resistance which is created in part by curriculum crowding. It's really hard to fit in more explicit learning programs into schools, particularly high schools. So the research around the world and our own research shows this too, that primary schools tend to be able to pick up and implement these programs, particularly when they're provided with well-constructed evidence-based programs. High schools typically find it really, really hard to implement or to implement in full or at all. And that's really the barrier of fitting something else into the timetable and sometimes into the curriculum structure of different subjects. Really, we do need a little bit of a policy push. And one of the things that might come now, I think, in the challenges of these times, is that with the increasing awareness of the mental health effects of social isolation, disruption, anxiety, the world becoming a dangerous place, that the population in general can see more readily the importance of investing in mental health promotion education, of which social emotional learning is a part. And therefore, with greater community agreement, we might find a way to make more spaces in our school day for these very important approaches.
Is there any research looking, given that this is a fairly new area, any research looking at young people who've been through some sort of trauma but have had this sort of social emotional training and how they do dealing with trauma?
So the research that's been done in these emergency contexts shows that children who are provided with social and emotional learning programs when they return to school after the emergency are far less likely to experience post-traumatic stress disorder and other forms of post-traumatic stress, which isn't actually at the disorder level, but nonetheless distress, tends to pass more quickly, and the children more quickly return to their more regular selves, who are more able to participate and focus on their learning. The other thing that's really interesting, given that we need to plan for a future where we know that disasters and emergencies will continue to occur, we're not always exactly sure when and for whom. And this research shows that children who do social emotional learning programs before they're exposed to disaster are also more able to cope and recover more quickly. So it's great prevention, it's great postvention. And the most wonderful thing, I think, actually, is that it's done through good education practice.
So we've been focusing on what children need and what teachers do for them in schools. But what about the teachers? If we're thinking about the bushfires that we had along the East Coast, the pandemic that now is affecting everybody, teachers are humans going through all sorts of trauma as well. What support do we give teachers in schools?
This is a really important question and it's often missed. More recently in research around post-emergency work in schools, it's come to attention that we really need to focus on teachers. In fact, one way of describing this need to attend to teachers has been in the suggestion that we consider them to be among the first responders in emergency. Because for many children, they are the only other people other than their family who will be there to help them deal with the impact of change, challenge, trauma. And then, of course, as we understand teachers being members of the communities they serve, they're often deeply affected by the trauma they're helping their children to deal with, their students to deal with. Their own families are affected, their neighbourhoods, the livelihoods of their partners and extended families may be affected as well. So, you know, when we're in a state of adrenaline and emergency, we pull out our best selves and we just run on empty. And then when the big challenge has abated, that can be when we just suddenly go, whoa, I've run out. So watching out for teachers in the longer term is really, really important in terms of their well-being and helping them understand and their leaders understand there may be a lag effect. The other thing we could do is lobby better politically for our teachers to encourage their institutions to lift off some of the regular demands around account, you know, some of the performative demands they have to satisfy in their systems that are not directly child-related and student-related, to lift some of them off at that time, to acknowledge that their workloads have increased enormously. The school leaders are in the position to most closely acknowledge that additional effort of the teachers. And people do need acknowledgement when they're running on empty. They do need to know that someone notices them and values what they do. And they do need their peers and their leaders to watch out, because some teachers won't manage to keep going without becoming unwell themselves. They might be carrying multiple traumas. They might be intensively affected in ways that others aren't. Or they might have been vulnerable before the emergency onset. So then we do need systems that can notice when teachers need more care, need time out of the classroom, need leave, or need therapeutic support. and to know that that is not something to be ashamed of any more than you should be ashamed of getting a sore throat and needing some antibiotics for it. It's something that happens when the system is pushed so hard that bits of it start to sag and need some care and attention.
Thank you so much for your time today, Helen.
It's a pleasure, Genevieve.
Helen's report, Natural Disasters and Pandemics, Supporting Student and Teacher Wellbeing After a Crisis, is available at education.unimelb.edu.au. That's all for now. Thanks for listening and take care.